Author Derek Jensen has written a number of groundbreaking books, most of which are for sale out there, that connect the destruction of the environment to the culture of entitlement that condones the exploitation of human and non-human communities and silences its victims. Derek's books include A Language Older Than Words, A Culture of Make-Believe, Listening to the Land, Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests, Welcome to the Machine, Science, Surveillance, and the Culture of Control. And his most recent book, his most recent book is Endgame, The Collapse of Civilization and Rebirth of Community, which should be available in about a year. Correct, Derek?
I just finished it last week.
Okay, how long? How long for it's available for print, though, for purchase? About a year? And we are also privileged to be joined by Ward Churchill, chair of the Department of Ethnic Studies at CU Boulder and one of the country's most important scholars chronicling the devastating impacts of the settler state on indigenous peoples in the United States and elsewhere. Ward's books include Marxism and Native Americans, Fantasies of the Master Race, Struggle for the Land, Agents of Repression, Since Predator Came, and A Little Matter of Genocide, Holocaust, and Denial in the Americas. Please join me in welcoming Derek and Ward. Derek and Ward have talked this over, and rather than begin with some prepared remarks, they actually just want to go to questions and answers. So we thought we would actually start there and do something a little unconventional. Imagine that. So, and anti-academic, you bet. So, questions. How many of you have questions?
I got a question. When did each of you begin writing? I mean, gosh, talk about prolific.
By that, I...
Books.
Yeah, okay.
Second grade, right?
I was going to say, I don't know, I was 23, 24 before I could spell my name, but 83 was the first book.
I guess my first book was probably 94, and my first really good book was probably 97, so that would make me 36 then.
Age-wise, I guess I would have been about the same. So. And that, yes, it means I'm older than him. Okay. What we thought we'd do was just stare at you intently until we questions, okay? We could do this like John Cage presentation, you know, extend 4 minutes and 57 seconds of silence into eternity. But.
The hand over there.
Yeah, fire away.
Well, I'm kind of new to the whole area of political science, but as people who've been in this, what sorts of things would you suggest that people start to do to get involved and to make people aware or to help with this movement towards making people aware of the environment and indigenous people, I mean, the fight that they're going through right now? I mean, what can people like me do to get involved in this and to help, basically, or just to make other people aware of what's going on?
Can
you
kind of repeat some of the
questions? Want to take that one first?
Yeah, actually.
Repeat some of them.
The question was, what can people do, I mean, especially people who are new to all this, what can they do to ally themselves with indigenous struggles to stop the depredations of the dominant culture? Is that a fair? I got something to start off with. Which is that one of the great things about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's a lot of great work to be done. And so the questions that I always ask are, what do you love? And what do you love enough to fight for? And what are your gifts? What are you good at? What are the biggest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? So, for example, I'm a good writer, and I'm a fast writer, and that's what I do. if I were good with explosives, I would do something else.
We can fix that.
It's books, man.
And so it's where your heart lies. And another thing I think is really important, I guess I got two more parts to this. Especially for people who are just starting, is to first, you know, I got this from you. One of the most important things we can do is decolonize our minds. Good. And so I'm going to just say that and then leave it to you to talk about it, since you were the one who taught me about that, actually. Another thing we can do is, it's really hard to fight the whole culture by yourself, and so it can be really helpful to find other people. The way I always say this is that I don't want to revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. So it's really important to try to find, I don't want to say community, because that makes it sound like I have to live with them or something, but, you know, find comrades, or find, what's the word, find community, find other people.
Affinity.
That when you say that fish are changing gender in the Platte, South Platte, that they don't go, so what? That go, okay, so what are we going to do about it? And then the third thing I think is really important, one of the reasons I can be so prolific now is because I spent most of my 20s figuring out who I am and getting grounded and getting a real, and really fully recognizing that I'm not the one who's crazy, the culture's crazy. And once again, finding out who I am and finding my place and finding what my gifts are, and then I could really dive into them. So I spent a lot of my 20s actually not doing that much. No, that's not true. That's not from a production standpoint. I spent a lot of my 20s listening to Rivers.
I'm going to respond to that one, and then we'll drag you in kicking and screaming. I think there's a piece here. He decided me. Now, I could go to Philip Deere. I could go to Fool's Crow. I can go to Matthew King. And I probably will before the evening's over. But I'm going to just go another direction, because that's sort of what we decided we'd do. Go kind of unexpected directions, perhaps. So I'm going to work off a German exchange student in France in 1968 by the name of Danny Combindé, who taught me this one, although it's a much older kind of slogan. But it goes to the decolonize your mind notion. And it goes like this. Be realistic. Demand the impossible. You demand anything less and then compromise that, you're going to end up where you don't want to be. But also, and this is what's really fundamentally important about that statement, is if you allow that which exists that you oppose to define reality for you, the existing order, your oppressor, whether you fully understand the nature of your oppression or not, if that entity, that thing, that consensus defines reality for you, your reality will always be to be oppressed, because that's all that's real to the oppressor. So you have to redefine reality, what's realistic in terms of liberation, and that's always defined by the existing order as impossible. Be clear. That point of clarity you can work out in terms of consciousness in an infinite number of directions, because it's all dots. All of these points of oppression and opposition all connect to one another. You cannot disconnect a system from itself and have a system, and the oppression, the nature of the oppression, is systemic, both in terms of consciousness and in terms of application. But it's a practical model. I'll return the compliment. I'll offer Derek as being a, not the, but a practical model. How does it go in Frank Zappa's song? When I first met Derek Jensen, I was not impressed. There was no reason to be. Hadn't done anything. He had an idea. He said, I want to interview. I'm doing this thing. I want to collect these interviews. I want to see how people relate these issues to one another, group to group, person to person, movement to movement. And I want to put that out there so people can examine it. All right? Fine. It's a good idea. Cost me a little to participate. He comes to interview me. we do an interview. Took about, what, 4 hours? It was a long one, as I recall. You had a lot of tape when you left. Then I didn't hear from him anymore. Well, that's not unusual. Fine. We had a conversation. Nothing much ventured. Nothing appreciably gained for a period of time, but nothing lost either. So what? Point one, he had a project and he finished it. There's a lesson to be learned. I don't know how many projects and good ideas I've encountered that remain exactly that 20 and 30 and 35 years later. Wow, support me, I've got an idea. Okay, we'll engage a little bit, but the key is not to have the idea. The key is to do something with it, turn it into something tangible. We did, there's follow through. You heard a bunch more follow through that came as a result of that, built on that. But first of all, he actually did it. Second of all, and this impressed me, out of all the verbiage that was expended that night, he got the essence of what I was saying in the interview, did not dilute, distort, corrupt, or turn it to his own advantage. Allowed my voice to come through in its own terms. Okay, and I would assume that's true of everyone else. But from that then, there's his own evolution follow-up, because everything that's happened since then, and you can read it, you can read it in series. You can see him connecting dots and continuing to evolve and continuing to take the nature of his evolution and consciousness and make it available to other people to be applied in whatever way they can. Now we got another series of dots that we connect. That's organization, that's motion, that's movement, that's how we transcend and defeat the existing order in the first instance. It's first of all a matter of consciousness. If you can't understand the nature of your oppressor, the nature of your enemy, you can never, ever hope to defeat. So, ground floor, exemplary action. And as he said, if he was expert with explosives, maybe he'd apply these lessons in another way. We're going to have a little training session after tonight's session. That's all I had to say. We got somebody got a question there, but do you have more on this?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing about that, which is about this evolution of consciousness. Can you hear me in the back, or do we need to move this over?
Yeah. We're sort of playing past the mic up here. Do we need the mic is the question.
Yes. Yeah.
We do, okay.
Okay, about this evolution of consciousness, when I wrote A Language Older Than Words, there was a chapter, and Ward gave me a blurb for it, and there was a chapter that I heard that you didn't like. And it was a chapter about, there was a line in there where I said, if you, what was it? Basically, one of the things I said was if we use counterviolence, then we run the risk of becoming like the oppressors. And at the time, that was what I had been taught, and that was what I had still believed in great measure, because I hadn't thought about it enough. And in the book that I just wrote, one of the things I do is I take about, for about 100 pages, I take all the main pacifist arguments and I show how they're for the most part nonsense. And one of the arguments that I take apart is that one, and just show how, you know, does because a mother grizzly bear fights back, does she become like those that she's fighting? Did Tecumseh become like the whites because he fought back? Did, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Did the Germans who attempted to assassinate Hitler, they become like Hitler because they did this? It's crazy. There's a woman who's being raped who kills the rapist. Does she become like a rapist? It's insane. So the point is that 7 years ago when I wrote The One, I still thought that. And now my consciousness has evolved where I see that that's just nonsense. And that's one of the things that happens. It's all process.
What can I do?
What can you do to combat it? Combat it. I mean, that's a simple answer. It's a multifaceted thing. It's a process and it's a state of mind that leads to this. You can challenge the state of mind beginning in yourself. And that's actually what he was just saying. You got to challenge, you got to interrogate your own set of assumptions and find out if they're valid or based on preference and privilege, if there's actually some validity to them. And you start breaking down all the kind of consciousness that wants to plaster no smoking signs on every flat surface in the immediate proximity of a plutonium dump. Okay, there's two things happening with that. Okay, one is a manifestation of delusion. You got denial going on, and you got a diversion going on. You're trying to displace onto something convenient, that which is much less convenient to try to confront. And what you're confronting there is a national security strait. If you're dealing with plutonium, your neighbors, probably poorer neighbors, if you decide to go with the anti-smoking thing, all right? But you got a progressive consensus that this is all for, well, what would it be for? Aside from comfort, convenience, and a reinforcement of privilege. Well, the alternative it is take those poor, less educated people and do something for their own good. Have we heard this before? Yeah. So, you know, you confront that kind of thing, which actually works its way out in a more structural sense to people, well, keeping that which is kind of other and a little bit plebeian and inconvenient out of their communities, which creates these communities under I-70, which are not populated by those who are privileged and elite and enlightened, and consequently make good dumping grounds for the cigarette butts, figuratively speaking, or the toxic chemicals, or the sewage treatment plant, or the, well, I can keep going. You understand? Those things connect. And you don't hear it getting connected in terms of environmental movement, in terms of progressive movement in general. We have a policy issue. That word came up. Where is policy formulated? What is the entity, the mechanism, formulation, the application, and the enforcement? It's something called the state. Progressives, so-called, sometimes even anarchists, so-called, turn to the state as the entity to solve the problems they confront. The state is the source of the problems. You got a sort of alchemy of consciousness going on here, that the solution to the problem is the source of the problem. Yes, yes, and if we do the correct incantations, we can take this bar of lead, repeat the same experiment long enough, circle that cauldron of bubbling fluid, and eventually it's going to turn out gold. Well, if you believe one, you better be believing the other. But that is a kind of consciousness that is not going to get you anywhere out of the mire you find yourself in now. So, you want to take that one and run with it? Okay, you can start just about any point you want to in Denver. I assume you're from Denver. You know, we could probably sit here and list about, in the time available, 2,000 different points of departure, things that you need to confront and just say no to in Denver. All right, pick one and approach it based upon your inclinations, your aptitude, your consciousness, and use that as a crucible of transforming your consciousness to the point where you can attack, attach, and transcend something else. Or something else is. Yeah?
I think that's great. And a couple things. One is, I think we're both probably going to talk a lot about revolution, whatever that may mean.
Not me.
Okay. Well, I may talk about revolution, whatever that may mean. And I'm going to get to something about that in a second. I also want to just sort of say for the record that I think that there can be very important, I don't want to use the R, the reform word, but I think that there can be very important, it sometimes is very important also to apply Band-Aids. And I don't have a problem with the application of Band-Aids to any circumstance so long as you recognize that it is no more than the application of a Band-Aid. Great examples of that are, I have no problem, obviously, with women working on rape crisis hotlines or in battered women's shelters. It's really important work, as long as they also recognize that that's not going to stop the tsunami of violence by men against women. And it's the same on any other issues, that I don't have a problem. I mean, I've done enough timber sale appeals myself, trying to work within the regulations of the state, and also every acre I ever helped to save was cut under the salvage rider, which is the point. And so I think that that work can be helpful so long as you recognize that that is nothing more than a Band-Aid. So that's the first part. And the second part is, for me, and I think one of the important realizations I had several years ago was that the government is a government of occupation, and the culture is a culture of occupation. Of course, all my American Indian friends said, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? And so at that point, for me, that was a huge transformation in understanding because, you know, people say, are you going to vote, blah, blah, blah. And I think that it does make a difference. If you're in occupied Nazi Germany, I would rather be in Denmark than Poland, you know, because Hans Frank was a worse governor. But in both cases, you're still under occupied territory. And what is the function of a government of occupation? It's to extract resources and extract resources. That's the primary function. And it's not to serve communities, and it's not to live sustainably, Well, see, there's also the question of defining reality. Because sustainably as defined by the dominant culture is bullshit. And there is, however, I mean, it is possible to live sustainably. I mean, people were doing it on this continent for at least 12,000 years, if you believe the myth of science, and if you believe the stories told by the people themselves, and it's since the beginning of time. And so it's possible to live sustainably. There's a real meaning by that. And I want to say one more thing, too. I was just talking to Karen about this earlier today, that I think one of the central questions, too, is with whom or what do you identify? And part of that can be in really practical sense. If you ask, where does your water come from? If you say your water comes from the tap, then you will defend the system that generates the water that comes out through the tap to the death. If you believe that your food comes from the grocery store, you will defend the system that feeds you to the death. If you believe, on the other hand, that the water comes from a stream, comes from underground, you will defend that. No, not if you believe. If you know that the water comes from underground, if you know that your food comes from the land base, you will defend that to the death. And so a lot of it has to do with what slash whom do you identify?
You're giving me room to run here, but that wouldn't be off the off question. So I don't know whether to pick up where he just left off, and we're starting to do volleyball between ourselves, or put it back to you. First of all, is there anybody got a pressing question you want to hear? This go a little further.
You know, I'm gonna have to stand up because I'm pushing my fucking phone. But I don't really have a question. I have more of a comment, uh-huh. And it's kind of maybe venting frustration. That it's typical to hear, and I'm not attacking. What can I do? Well, there's so many things to do, and there's events happening all the time. You know, Transform Columbus. How many people got arrested? Well, I see some of y'all that did. But I mean, we had been talking about this forever, and then when it came down to it, nobody did it. And I can't get arrested. They don't have any warrants. There's nothing going on. Well, these things need to happen in order for change to happen. And then on campus, there's always discussions of whether it's Free Palestine, movies on Iraqis. I mean, there's always something going on, but my schedule doesn't make it up. For whatever reason, people don't attend these events. I'm a therapist at Lincoln High School and at Clinton Middle School. Today, I have four kids. One kid who's Native American, and the teacher told him that they were savages and that all these things. He had a little medicine pouch. The teacher took it apart, brought the advisors in because they thought it might have marijuana in it. A kid got kicked out of class today for speaking Spanish. I mean, these things are happening now every day. And so I just have a hard time with just, you know, what do we do? Well, let's first of all open our eyes and then let's get involved and see what's happening. Let's watch Democracy Now! Instead of South Park or, you know, whatever it is, and attend some of these events. Right now, I'm like the only Latina in my master's program, which is so sad. And then the curriculum is all Eurocentric and it's all geared to one population. The DSM-4 doesn't relate to Mexicans. These assessments don't, but then we're not getting anything in lieu of, I'm sorry. But, you know, I'm just having I just feel like there's so much that we can be doing, but we only pick, and not that we can attend to all the causes out there, but we just kind of pick one thing and we feel sad for the fish, but then there's kids that are dying, and there's kids that are, you know, this is happening too, and Latinos and everything that's happening. I just feel frustrated and angered, and I just feel like if we were really committed and we really wanted to create change, there are so many ways every single day to do that, and I think one of it is not to be so isolated. Denver is so segregated. You know, we might even be Alabama. You know, we know where the white people live. We know where Mexicans live. We know where black people live. Nobody cruises up and down Federal. Nobody goes to Five Points unless they're going to Cafe Nuba to have some sort of like, you know, awakening experience to go listen to open words, you know, open mic and spoken words, you know, and that's the only time that they'll ever go there. But they don't shop in those districts. They don't go to BBB and see these little shirts, you know, that our little five-year-olds are wearing, and then wonder why we have the highest teen pregnancy rate. I'll be done.
No. First of all, don't be sorry. I said that three times. There's nothing to be sorry about. Put it down. But yeah, okay, you bring up an interesting example. We may have made a tactical error here. I'll just maybe put this out publicly for the first time. We used to do, well, in the Columbus stuff, phase one, we didn't have a Four Directions march. It was a confrontational thing. People came to confront the parade. And in 92, we had 2,500, 3,000, I don't know. We had mass turnout, and people were ready to go. Then we have this hiatus. But now, instead of just confrontation, we got to present an alternative, too. And that's fine. You should present the alternative if you're going to confront. So we incorporate the Four Directions March on the same day as the parade, and we got a couple thousand people, 3,000 people, maybe. I don't know. Again, I don't count that well. We had a whole bunch of people. Now we've broken the Four Directions march off from the confrontation. And there's a certain logic to that, not to corrupt our alternative with what it is we're confronting. So what was the turnout at the Four Directions march this year? 2,000 people showed up to take a walk and to celebrate unity and to feel good. And the next day, when it came time for the confrontation, there were 200 people on the street. 1 in 10 actually took it from feel good into any kind of action. And this was not particularly significant or consequential or risky action. Newsflash, change implies taking risk. Change implies dedication, commitment, and struggle, and yeah, sacrifice. Sacrifice. You got to be willing to invest something more than a good time and a walk in the sun. And it's not a rock concert. It's not a fashion statement. It's not a change in diet. It's not reading all the works of Jack Kerouac. It's not taking the right drugs. It's not riding bicycles instead of doing cars. It's no painless way to do the undoing of that which inflicts pain as a concomitant of its existence. And the pain doesn't go away because you avoid it. Maybe you can displace it from a position of privilege, leaving it on a child she was talking about, emblematic of all the children that suffer the burden of this system. But if you're serious in any sense at all about actually making change rather than making a progressive fashion statement, you're gonna have to do more than show up on the night when you know you can't possibly be arrested for the weighty offense of, what do they charge us with? Loitering. Wow. Heavy karma. Probably gonna get us disbarred and disemployed. Loitering. If you can't risk that, then stay home. Don't come celebrate. You got nothing to celebrate because nothing's going to change. The unity isn't unity. It's a party. Yeah? So we need to be bringing that Four Directions march back into the context of struggle where it belongs, which is on the Saturday when the parade occurs, if it occurs again, so that at least the people who came just to walk, just to feel good, just to pretend they're someone other than who they are, has to witness people who will do at least a little bit more. And maybe that will have a little galvanizing and transformative effect in terms of consciousness where they're willing to risk the equivalent of a parking ticket. Okay then, yeah. Jump. But did you have anything you wanted to add to that? Okay, wait a minute. There's two of us, so one response doesn't get it.
I don't know if y'all know this, but the first draft of the movie Star Wars was written by environmentalists. And it has a slightly different ending. In this version, they don't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, what they do is they stand on the planet to be destroyed, and they hold hands or tentacles, and they sing Give Peace a Chance. And they send a CD to Darth Vader. And they also organize boycotts of any corporation on which Darth Vader is a member of the board of directors. And they also make, they have the people on the planet.
You have to be kidding.
They have people on the planet make hemp hacky sacks that they then sell to people on the Death Star to show that the planet is actually economically viable. And there's a few people who get really, really brave. And what they do is they head up to the Death Star and they chain themselves to the transporters on the Death Star. And some of the ones break off because they think that's too wimpy. So they break off and they head down the walls. And they spray GLF, or Galaxy Liberation Front, on some of the walls. And then they head back to the planet, where, of course, all the people on the planet then turn them in to the Empire, because they're destroying their demonstration. And then right before, it's really cool, because right at the end of the movie, the one problem with the plot, the way they have it, is that there's a bit too much talking and not enough action. Yeah, which, you know, that's just art imitating reality. And anyway, so then on the planet, it's really cool because right at the end, right before the planet gets blown up, you see the environmentalists all head off on a spaceship to another planet, so they all get saved. And then the very, very end of the movie is there's an article on like page 24 of the Empire Times, a little article about this big saying the planet was destroyed. And then the final shot is all the environmentalists going, "Yes, we got press."
I love it.
Okay, so the point is that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. You know, name your favorite atrocity. There was, what's the one about little girls and puberty? What are the figures on that? It's about human sperm counts have been cut in half in the last 50 years. At the same time, girls have begun to enter puberty earlier. 1% of 3-year-old girls have begun to develop breast or pubic hair. And only the last 6 years, the percentage of girls under 8 with swollen breast or pubic hair has gone from 1% to 6.7% for white girls and 27.2% for black girls. How many people in this room have had someone you love die of cancer? That's actually really low. Most of the times when I ask that question, it's about 75 to 100%. What we need to do is to dismantle everything we see around us. We need to bring down all of civilization. It is killing the planet. And we need to have our... There are 65,000 dams in this country over 6.5 feet tall. There are 2 million dams in this country total, about. Nobody knows, because nobody knows how many there are. They've never even bothered to count the goddamn things. And if we only take out one dam a day, it would take us, 70,000 dams, or 365 days in a year, 3,600 would be 10 years, 100 years, 200 years to take out all the big dams at one a day. The Columbia River salmon don't have that time, nor do any salmon. And it doesn't matter, once again, you know, you can connect all the dots, whether we're talking about the little girls with their undergoing puberty earlier, or whether we're talking about the extirpation of salmon. If we're not going to fight back when children are being poisoned, when precisely, if those we purport to love are dying of cancer because of the toxification of the total environment, when exactly? I mean, give me a specific threshold. Give me a point. I don't care what the point is, but give me a point at which you'll finally do something. You know, I mean, pick any point. And then it's like, oh, well, what's going to happen then is when you get to the point, it's like, well, okay, we'll move the point back just a little bit. And I want to say one more thing about this, which is that one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they co-opted hope and co-opted rationality. Oh, I want to say two things then. So that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move? I think I will probably just go ahead and get an ID card. You want to go to a ghetto? You want to resist and possibly get killed. You want to get on a cattle car? You want to resist and possibly get killed. You want to take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed. At every step in the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. And part of the reason for that was because they had hope. And there's two directions I can go with that. One very briefly is that one of the most important things I think we can do is eradicate false hope. Does anybody really believe that if we just ask nicely that warehouses are going to stop deforesting? Does anybody really believe that if we ask nicely that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing? So I think it's really important to get out of that. One of the things, one of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't bad women's shelters in the 50s and 60s, but another reason was because of the false hope that he would change. And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. So false hopes are just bad, get rid of them. Okay, then I was bashing hope last time I was in Denver at the Four Winds place, and somebody in the audience said, "So you're bashing hope, can you define it, please?" And it's like, oh my God, I've been bashing hope for years, I don't know what it means. So I asked the audience to define hope. And the audience came up with a great, there's probably some of you were there, the audience came up with a great definition, which was, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. I don't hope that I eat tomorrow. I know men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I'm going to commit to it right here, right now. I will eat tomorrow. I will sleep tonight. The next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash, because I don't have agency over that. So if I say, I hope that salmon survive, what I'm saying is that I have no agency. So the truth is, I don't hope that salmon survive. I will do what it takes to make sure that they survive. And so we can say the same thing about all this other stuff. I can say, I hope that environmental racism goes away. I'm not picking on you. You didn't say that. But it's like, on the other hand, I can say, I don't hope environmental racism goes away, because I will do what it takes to make sure it goes away.
I want to do an audience poll, because we're right on the cusp. How many people in here actually think the election of John Kerry, my old friend from BVAW, will make a tangible difference to children in migrant labor camps in California?
I do.
Okay. That's about the age you need to be. Okay, so you're a good illustration. Thank you. Children in Brownsville, South Central Los Angeles. I haven't seen a single hand yet. Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Iraq, Afghanistan, why does anybody care whether John Kerry or George Bush is elected next week?
Because we know George Bush has already pissed us off enough.
Yeah, so we can pretend that we did something that will affect a change, which we already know before the fact is not going to be forthcoming. There'll be some cosmetic changes. They do have different approaches. There might even be some safety nets constructed here to buy people off from the discontent they're feeling, because it could always get worse then, which is a way of making the system function more efficiently. I thought we were opposing the system. I'm going to leave that one. I'm just going to let that one sit there. Because you know as well as I do, people purporting to be oppositionists, to be progressive, to be enlightened, they get furious when you say, voting isn't a relevancy, it's a diversion of consciousness, it's tapping energy that could go to constructive purposes and putting people into a masturbatory ritual every 4 years of pretending they are going, that's that alchemy and circling the rock again. That's painlessness. That's pretending you can take the right pill and transform the universe. And by the way, when you were starting off with the alternative closing scenes on Star Wars, if I was Abby Hoffman, I would have been asking what kind of acid these guys were taking, because we all need some so that we can reconceive the universe. But it's not going to happen that way. It didn't happen that way for Abby either. How many people think you can petition anybody that's going to be in power in this government and affect any kind of fundamental change? not a soul. This is a really enlightened group. How many people think you can go to court, make the right argument, and have what would be required? Federal court to order the dissolution of the government of the United States? I mean, it's part of the government of the United States. So you're not going to get resolution of the actual grievances through the judicial process. You know that. You know that as surely as I do. Voting's not going to do it. Petitions are not going to do it. Litigation's not going to do it. Even if you went to the world court and there's the question of enforcement, who would enforce the court order? Who's responsible for enforcing that order? Who's responsible for compelling compliance on the part of this entity that governs us all? Compliance with law, compliance with the fundamental norms of human decency, and we could hope for more than that, but at least at those thresholds. Who's responsible for that? Oh yes, there's someone. There's something called Nuremberg Doctrine, which the United States, and ironically enough, was instrumental in formulating, saying that the citizenry of each country is legally obligated to do whatever it takes to compel compliance with the fundamental norms and standards of international legality. Note, they didn't say everything but this, that, and the other. They said do what's necessary. The German public was condemned by implication at Nuremberg for having defaulted on its fundamental responsibility to do whatever it took to put the Hitler government back on a legal leash so that it couldn't do what it did. And in the default of the citizenry, the Second World War was necessary to accomplish that. How was the German government put on a legal leash? 8th Air Force, saturation bombing. We'll inflict as much carnage and pain on you as you're inflicting on everybody else until you've had enough and you'll stop. Well, maybe if the citizenry of Germany had assumed its fundamental responsibilities, not only in terms of German citizenship, but world citizenship, they could have done that a much less painfully. But they defaulted on the responsibility, so they had no complaint. Well, they complained, and there were war crimes committed against them. But the instigation was on their end, so there's not too many people feeling greatly sorry for them. Hey, good Germans, there's nobody doing what it takes. And you know it's not going to happen through any of the approved rituals. If the state will sanction and approve it, it means it has absolutely no capacity to alter the functioning of the state. That's that consciousness clarity again. And I don't think that's a newsflash to anybody. I think that's something you fundamentally understood already. Everybody in this room and a lot of people outside it. So there's a little game of let's pretend that we can do these things that are actually not consequential and feel better about ourselves by virtue of a symbolic distancing from that which we oppose, but oppose only in a way that allows it to continue because otherwise it might be uncomfortable and we get hurt. And that displaces, that pretense displaces the pain on a continuing basis onto the children in the migrant labor camp and in Brownsville and in South Central Illinois, L.A., South Illinois for that matter, Pine Ridge Reservation, Iraq, Afghanistan, all those marginal for the centers of power, prestige, and privilege. And that is by virtue of the insistence upon the constraints of the ritual, something accepted and approved by people who purport to be in opposition to it, and that is inexcusable. That is delusional behavior. That is complicity in the crime. And at least it can be said that the right, the fascists, the whoever's of the world have the honesty to own the fact that they agree with it. There's something to be said for honesty, and that goes back to interrogating your own assumptions, your own beliefs, your own conceptions of who you are, coming to grips with who that actually is, matching that up into who it is you want to be, and doing what's necessary to transform yourself. In that process, you transform your consciousness and your actions, and out of that grows the capacity to transform that which we oppose. No place else. No place else.
I take it you're voting for Kerry.
I wouldn't vote for anybody but John Kerry. He sold me out in 1971, and I'm bound and by God determined to give him a chance to do it big time now. Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't about talking about war crimes. It was about selling BBAW out. It was about doing exactly the opposite of what it was he was condemned for doing, quite falsely now. Man had no integrity whatsoever then. Why would you expect him to have some now? He's a professional absence of integrity kind of guy. That's a fresh old qualification for the job he's been holding ever since. And that's the progressive alternative. Oh, yeah. There we're having the hearings from the vets who were actually exposing the war crimes, and there he is talking to senators and congressmen, getting his markers down to get elected.
You're a vet yourself, then,
are you? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did my part in the Colonial Army. Okay, and I'll own that straight up. I'm a war criminal, said so at the time. Guess what? They don't want to put me in jail for that. They want to put me in jail for opposing war crimes. That's the truth of it. That's where you get with the courts. Go and confess to war crimes and they'll give you a medal and send you home.
The town of Humboldt, or the county, Humboldt County, just one county south of where I live in Northern California, has the second highest per capita rate in California. Humboldt County, just south of where I live, has the second highest per capita rate of rape. And last year, the Humboldt County sheriffs arrested, I believe, I don't know, 15, 16, or 20 tree sitters. And they, using great violence, pain compliance, all that stuff, and they arrested two rapists, which just makes very clear the priorities of... And we all know that, I don't know what the percentage is, but we all know that a great percentage of women who are in prison are in for, or in doing life for prison, are in for killing their abusers. And, oh, there's a great one I read not very long ago. This guy was, he beat his wife, and for that he was going to get, I think a month or some fairly small amount. And then when the cop came to arrest him, he spat on the cop, for which he was going to get life. He's in Oklahoma. I can send you the citation on that if you want.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the way it should go.
Well,
because within this culture is based on a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is invisible. Or it's fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is blasphemy.
I thought you only got life for writing bad checks.
No, another phrase of yours that I'm going to steal is contempt of cop.
Yeah, well,
that can be life.
That is the crime.
Between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police. And on the other hand, and we never hear about that, but on the, we for the most part. And on the other hand, every time a cop dies, it's a big state funeral. But I'll let you in on a secret, which is that the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection. Far more dangerous. But when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where he's this garbage inspector cleaning up the mean streets of L.A.? So violence can only go down. So the cops get to use violence, but no one can use violence back up. And it's, of course, the exact same thing is true in domestic violence situations. It's true at the state level. And anybody who doesn't believe me, I mean, try hitting a cop with a baseball bat, and I'll talk to you in about 65 years.
You can live long enough to talk to him in 65 years to do that. Yeah.
And this person over here had his hand up a long time ago.
Okay, and then we got one here who's been sort of being very polite, actually.
Okay. You talked about first creating awareness for those that are causing pain and or oppressing. The second thing you said was figure out what gifts you have to take action and take the right action on it. And then the third one you were talking about was then evaluating the action you've taken, say, you were talking about when you had written in your book, now writing your new book, you've got a different stance on it. My question is, what other evaluations have you guys taken like that that are different from the actions you've taken before? And maybe you want to express that now.
I'm not...
It's like, essentially, you took the action in your book to write that if there's violence, you can't fight violence with violence. And then in the new book, it says, well, that's not true. I don't believe in that anymore. Now it should be, you're going to have to take some kind of action if it's violence.
It's circumstantial.
Absolutely. My question now is, what other situations have you guys come upon where now you're starting to change your thinking on it?
I was an engineer. Crying out loud. I mean, all right, it doesn't get much more. Oh my God, I was a Republican. I voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Dude.
If he would have won by one vote, I would have just killed myself. And then in 84, I voted for a freaking Democrat. And then I real and then in 88, I think I voted for Emma Goldman. Mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines. God help me.
And Emma Goldman, the anarchist.
Yeah. I mean, I was a fundamentalist Christian when I was a kid. I mean, that was an adult at least. There's been some major shifts early, and, you know, we can talk. I mean, at one point I thought that perhaps it was possible to for the planet to survive with industrial civilization. I still believe that for a while. That one got stripped away probably 10, 12, 13 years ago. There's been those shifts. Lately, there haven't been so many shifts. I think I've been more and more clear. And the shifts have been smaller. You know, like something I don't get, and then I start to get.
Oh, damn, we're going to do true confessions here now, huh? Boy, howdy. Okay, then. Right back there in 1964, I want you to know I campaigned fervently for Lyndon Baines Johnson. The reason I did that was because there was this guy named Goldwater. And Goldwater promised that if he got elected, he was going to drop my butt and send it to Vietnam. So I did what was necessary, borrow a line from you, make sure Lyndon won, which he did. I'm responsible for that, okay? 18 months later, I was jumping out of airplanes in preparation to go to Vietnam. That is why I got my education on the difference between Republicans and Democrats, okay? Size that one up. Who is the honest guy there? Goldwater. Oh, you think that you're going to get something out of Democrats here, newsflash from American Indian, the only party we've ever gotten anything out of in terms of tangible return and restoration of land rights in the entire 20th century. Well, I named one of them. It was a combination of Demon, Barry Goldwater, Richard Nixon collaborated to return the Blue Lake to the Taos Pueblo. That was the biggest land restoration in the entire 20th century. In fact, there wasn't any other substantial land restoration. We lost land under every single Democratic administration for the entire century. Goes against the conventional progressive orthodoxy. It's, I suppose, in that sense, counterintuitive. If you actually want to get tangible results, you're more likely with a Republican than you are with a Democrat, but neither of those alternatives is acceptable. That's what I learned out of that piece of false consciousness. Politically active, thinking I was doing the right thing, and out of pretty narrow self-interest, but actually it was beneficial to the Vietnamese. I can always think of it that way. Okay, I tried not to go kill them. I don't think probably tried hard enough, do you? I know they don't think I did. I tried hard enough. Fast forward 5 years, 1969, I was a part of something called the Days of Rage, October 8th through 11th, Chicago, Illinois, weather faction. Okay, we're going to take the Chicago police force on toe-to-toe in the street with the baseball bat. I'll cut to the chase on that one real quick. Not doing that again. Yeah. Yeah, I put the Corporation Council of the City of Chicago in the hospital as a paraplegic with a broken neck. Name was Richard Elrod. Then they couldn't figure out what to do with him. Said, what's the most useless position in Chicago? Said, sheriff. Sheriff doesn't do anything. So Democratic Party ran Richard Elrod for sheriff. We put the guy who broke his neck up as the opposing candidate and got 12,000 votes. Okay, we'll do that one again. Yeah, those are true stories. I learned out of that. You don't fight them on their terms, on their chosen ground. Maybe suck them into being on ground you choose and do what you're going to do someplace else. Learn from your experience. There's two. I can keep going. I'll give you one more. I moved to South Dakota, 1975, towards the culminating phase of the Angoon Wars, it's called, which was really a counterinsurgency war waged by the United States against the American Indian movement and the traditional Oglala Lakotas and their other supporters on Pine Ridge Reservation. Part of those goons were tribal cops and other members of the tribe who were assimilated. That is, I use that word, tribe, in this sense, okay? It means animal grouping, doesn't mean people. There is no dignity to it, okay? We are peoples, we are nations, we are not tribes. But the goons were members of a tribe, okay? Part of them were white. In the white part, Tom Mix County Rangers, vigilante organizations were primarily members of the John Birch Society, white ranchers, and people work for white ranchers. And I hated them. No, crystalline, clear, we're killing each other kind of hate. That's 1975-76. 1981-82, something happened in the interim. Educated them, educated me as a result of their education, okay? Government came up with the idea of installing something called the Etsy Pipeline. They were going to take the groundwater out of the Madison Formation in the Oglala Aquifer, okay, pump it into slurry lines and slurry coal from the Wyodak coal mine up by Gillette all the way across the Plains region to Wisconsin. They had the idea of actually taking it all the way down to Arkansas in another version. This would have depleted the groundwater for the entire area of South Dakota and Wyoming in about 5 years. And that would have made it unranchable. Suddenly, these Bircher ranchers discovered that they were in the position of Indians to all practical intents and purposes. And boy, did that change their way they looked at things.